Tom King is the president and CEO of Kintronics Labs Incorporated. He holds a BSEE and an MSEE from the University of Tennessee and is a co-holder of a patent while employed by the U.S. Navy. He has authored or co-authored numerous technical papers on AM broadcast antenna systems and related topics. Tom is an associate member of the Association of Federal Communications Consulting Engineers, a member of the IEEE Broadcast Technology Society, and a member of the National Radio Standards Committee. Tom is a recipient of the 2015 NAB Radio Engineering Achievement Award. Please welcome Tom King.
Thank you very much. And I do want to thank Leonard and the committee that have enabled me to speak with you this afternoon on a subject that's very important to me, and that is AM revitalization. What I'm going to be sharing with you is the content of what our company submitted to the FCC in response to the notice for proposed rulemaking on AM revitalization. And this is really addressing issues that we believe are critical to the quality of AM service, and not just affecting the rules themselves. So what I'm going to be talking about is three particular critical steps to AM revitalization. And I want to give particular credit to this presentation, a large part of it, to Dr. Steve Smith, who was a consultant to our company when all this was put together. And he has certainly had a major part in this. And I think to begin, AM is a critical service that has been demonstrated over and over to be the most important source and reliable source of information in major disasters such as Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Katrina. And I think FEMA, which Al Kenyon is representing here, have invested heavily in the PPAC network, which is largely comprised of AM stations that are clear channel stations to mainly cover the largest area population possible, and particularly at night. As far as AM radio is concerned, as you know, it's in dire straits. The listenership is steadily declining. Revenues are falling. And what is the major problem? Well, one is that the reception is so poor because radio receiver bandwidths are so low because noise is so high. And as a result, people are turning to FM as opposed to AM, which is understandable because the quality of the audio is so much better. So what we're proposing here, there's three possible paths forward for AM. One is to continue the current course that we're on. The second one is to consider an analog sunset. And the third is to consider the three critical steps that we're proposing. First of which is to conduct a noise study in the 0.5 megahertz to 2 gigahertz band, which encompasses all the wireless communications that we know today, and review and modify as appropriate the Part 15 and Part 18 rules that apply to those. Secondly, is to establish AM receiver specs that put AM receivers on parity with FM receivers. And lastly, is to adopt AM synchronization, which would serve to increase the effective coverage area of stations dramatically and would eliminate a lot of the interference issues that we hear in overlap regions of co-channel stations. Okay, so these are some legal precedents that the FCC has taken that relate to radio and television services that we wanted to bring to their attention and to your attention, just to show that they have had an active role in the past in implementing rules. Among these are the denial of AM stereo in 1961 to assure success for FM,
The adoption of FM stereo standard was in 1961. And then in 1961, they also passed the UHF Television All Channel Act to add UHF channel selectors to televisions. The commission also solicited AM stereo proposals in 1979-80, and they selected the Magnavox system. But then there was so much legal backlash from that they canceled it. And then they went to the market approach, and that failed. TV stereo, adopted by the industry with the commission's blessing in 1984. In 1993, the AMAX receiver was introduced, but there was no commission mandate to require those particular standards for receivers. So again, receivers were left unimpacted by this great technology that was introduced. And finally, CQAM approval in 1993, but that was too late for any without receiver mandates. As a result, AM basically has been left to drift. And as a result, the public interest in AM has declined. This is a hypothetical scenario. If I can ask you to consider this for a moment, in which case we are looking at the declining revenue of AM, where we see here, this is the total radio audience. As you can see here, this is 17% down to 11.5% here, okay? And this is in what's happened in recent years. And then if we project a analog sunset around 2019, we're going to see a significant drop in listenership as a result of that, because AM receivers are going to have to be available and stations are going to have to be using digital radio. There's only about 250 AM stations currently running HD out of around 4,700. And if we see an increase in digital use, and we see at the same time, if we see a reduction in noise, implementing new standards on noise, then we can see effectively over time an increase in AM listenership. And the noise spectrum that's out there today affects not just analog but digital. And it affects everything from DC to light practically. So it's not just a broadcast situation, it's a much broader concern, which is one of the issues we've been trying to make with the FCC. So part 15 of the FCC rules is where we need to focus on making changes and encouraging changes. And this is something that really needs the encouragement of the AM broadcasters. First of all, the noise sources that we're primarily concerned about are those that are most familiar to you, I'm sure, which are overhead services of any kind, whether it be power or cable, DSL, what have you. All of these have related noise contributing to the overall broadcast spectrum and wireless communication spectrum. And then also we have consumer devices, which include a lot of the LED products that are being dumped on the market now, largely made in China. And one of the things that I would like to certainly make note of is that right now the FCC's policy regarding all these devices is that these manufacturers are left to regulate themselves. And the FCC is not overlooking the products that are coming in. They're not randomly sampling them off the shelf and putting them in the lab and testing them to see if they're compliant. And generally, they're not compliant. And this is a problem. And it takes a lot of reaction from you, the broadcasters, to make a difference. The legal solution requires active enforcement now, not later. And all the sources that we're concerned about are typically categorized as unintentional radiators, intentional radiators, or home devices. All right, so what should we do? First of all, and this is a presentation that we've presented to Commissioner Pye and to other commissioners, as well as to Chairman Wheeler's legal counsel. First of all, we're recommending that we should have random sampling of devices that are being dumped on the market, that are being sold by Walmart, Best Buy, etc., that are RF emitters. Any non-compliance should result in hefty fines and potentially injunctions against the companies that are marketing them. AM stations need to actively take a role in this and require the FCC to pursue this type of action. FCC Labs has been recently reduced in their budget and in their responsibilities, and this is not helping the situation at all. Public interference complaints should be directed to those that, such as the Public Utility Commission, or to the FCC directly. How can you do that? Well, these are some instructions that I received in an email from Commissioner Mignon Clyburn that tells you how you can respond to any noise interference concerns that you have. And I would particularly point out this particular website right here, that you can send an email to them via that site, or you can call them at this phone number. And the important thing is that they hear from you. And this can be any type of interference that you're familiar with. For instance, I know Jim Glogowski, Director of Multicultural Broadcasting, was telling me that he had situations where he would pull up to a traffic light. It was an LED traffic light. And as soon as he pulled up to the light, it just totally drowned out the AM radio. And there again, that's something you can contact the local Public Utility Commission or the Highway Department, say, this is a problem, we need to do something about it. They've got to hear from you, or nothing's going to happen. That's one of the things that I find when we talk to the FCC, they say, well, nobody's telling us anything, nobody's concerned, nobody's worried about it. And this is a problem that needs to change. There are two articles that were recently published concerning noise. The first of these was published in the IEEE Spectrum in July, and one of the authors of that particular article is Dennis Roberson, who is the chairman of the FCC Technical Advisory Council, which is the council in the FCC that addresses technical issues that are ultimately reported to the chairman for impacting rules. And in this case, Dennis Roberson and his cohorts here have presented data that they collected, and they made a statement, which I'll show in the next slide here, regarding the current need for noise data to be collected. The second article, which has just appeared in the IEEE BTS newsletter, was from the ITU. The title, Drowning in a Sea of Man-Made Noise. And this is these are just two publications in the last 2 months that have occurred and been published that speak to this problem. It's a growing problem worldwide, not just in the United States. This is a statement that was in the article and that appeared in IEEE Spectrum. There hasn't been a systematic study of radio frequency noise in the U.S. since the mid-1970s, when the Institute for Telecommunications Science, as a part of the National Telecommunications Information Administration, last monitored federal use of the radio spectrum. So this is the last time that an actual noise study was conducted. And the statement at the end of this particular paper was that this is a critical issue that needs to be dealt with now. It's affecting services, not broadcast, broadband, telecommunications, everybody. Now I'm going to turn to the subject of receivers. And what can we do about receivers to improve them? And these are issues that we need to, these are items that we need to improve with regard to receivers. Basic technical standards that need to be implemented, including reducing the internal noise floor of a receiver, higher overall RF sensitivity, selectivity, and dynamic range, highly effective noise EMI rejection, full 10 kilohertz audio bandwidth capability with low detector distortion and stereo capability. AM receivers can have a quality and yield a quality that is comparable to FM if we produce them to do so and if we require them to do so. These give you some of the standards that we are proposing for AM receivers. We presented this to Peter Doyle, chief of the audio media branch of the FCC, and he told us that the FCC was not in a position to establish new radio standards without direction from Congress and the Senate. So this is an issue that is required and necessary, but it's something that is going to have direction from Capitol Hill. This shows the comparison between AM and FM receivers and why we believe changes need to be made. As you can see, the audio bandwidth of an FM receiver is 15 kilohertz. It's 10 kilohertz on a wideband AM receiver. But typically, the bandwidth of receivers today is around 2.5 to 3 kilohertz because of the noise environment and because of no interest in making them better. Signal-to-noise ratio of an FM receiver is 65 dB. It's typically 35 dB in an AM receiver. We propose that that be increased to 55 dB. Sensitivity of an FM receiver is 2 microvolts. AM is currently 500 microvolts. We're proposing an order of magnitude increase to 20 microvolts for AM receivers. This is all achievable with current technology without any problem. Selectivity, 40 over 60 dB for 45 to 60 dB over from FM and AM 40 to 50 dB, which with adaptive filtering is easily achievable. And these are all various improvements that can be implemented with current technology. And using, certainly one of the things that we're recommending is an improved receive antenna in automobiles. Using a H-field antenna where you have various areas in a car with different orientations that one could easily implement an antenna and use a variable capacitor to tune it on the frequency of the station. That would dramatically increase the reception of an AM radio in a car. Now I'm going to look at some different scenarios here. I'm going to go ahead. This shows the comparative bandwidth between a typical AM receiver, 2.5 kilohertz here, the full bandwidth of an NRSC compliant transmitted AM station, and the 15 kilohertz bandwidth of a FM station. And here you can see the we're talking about AM reception cases. I'm going to look at three different cases. We're going to talk about adaptive noise filtering that is achievable with technology that we have today. And we're going to look at three different cases. One is the a close-in station with 10 millivolts per meter contour, suburban 2 millivolts per meter, and the fringe at 0.5 millivolt per meter. And look at these different cases and how we can adapt a receiver to receive the audio maximally within each of these situations. We'll use the receiver response dependent on relative carrier modulation levels, dynamic bandwidth, signal cancellation, and audio expansion performed digitally in higher performance plus lower cost and complexity. This is all using digital signal processing. So current AM receivers only reproduce about a quarter of the transmitted bandwidth. To balance the sound, the bass is cut to compensate for the lack of highs. Current receivers have no stereo, no noise limiting, and poor RF performance. This is looking at a case where we have a close-in signal at 10 millivolts per meter, full bandwidth with low noise on the adjacent channel or the alternate channel at 20 kilohertz separation. And this is where we have maximally flat response here. And now if we go to a what would be called a suburban signal of 2 millivolts per meter, then we're with a higher level of noise on the adjacent channel here, we narrow the bandwidth down to about 7.5 kilohertz. And then as we go to less received signal in the fringe area, and we see more noise coming in on the sidebands, we adapt the sideband response down to either sideband down to whatever it requires. But we're able to monitor the sidebands because these latest Silicon Labs chips, which we're working with and developing this receiver, have dual processors that allow us to do this kind of thing. We can do pre-processing before we drive the final stage so that we can adjust the bandwidth to give us maximum response, even asymmetrically, and while maintaining left and right stereo separation. And this is the typical architecture of a receiver that we're talking about. This is for both AM and FM, where we have a AM RF front end here, FM RF front end here with noise limiting, feeding a quadrature mixer, and then we have a local oscillator synthesizer feeding the going into the I and Q low IF filters here, and then into A to D converters to a DSP, and then an external DSP, which is optional with final digital to analog conversion back to the speakers. And this shows the block diagram of a Motorola Sequam receiver that was produced by Motorola, which to highlight some of the noise suppression features that this receiver had. First of which was this pin diode here on the input for antenna input front end fast clamping. And then we have the mixer output with a trigger blanker right here. And then we have an IF output detector input delayed blanker here. And then we have audio output delayed sample and hold here, and a variable 10 kilohertz notch filter on the output. These were all features that were incorporated in the original Sequam receivers. These are features that we're incorporating into a new receiver that we are developing today. Among these include signal delay with look-ahead processing, memory storage for signal averaging, adaptive limiting and blanking with delays, single sideband and vestigial sideband processing for adjacent channel interference, asymmetric sideband filtering for ACI rejection, dynamic front-end AGC and antenna tuning, dynamic spectral measurements, dynamic audio noise reduction expansion, fast noise floor assessment, Sequam stereo correction, program-independent bandwidth control, synchronous detection for lower distortion and selective fading. All these are features that are realizable with today's technology that can produce a radio receiver that will truly give parity with FM. And you would say, you know, why are we doing this? Because we're in the digital age. Well, I think that there is still a great need and interest for a better quality analog receiver. There is, and I'm not just saying in the U.S., but I'm saying worldwide. And the fact is that AM can be better today using this technology. It's available today. And all we have to do is implement it and get it out into the public to use until digital ultimately takes over, which we hope it will. Now I'm going to turn to the subject of synchronous AM, which is the third step that we were recommending for AM revitalization. All of these are steps, again, that are realizable with today's hardware capabilities. And AM synchronous boosters are something that are in use today by, I think, 6 or 7 stations in the U.S. and in Puerto Rico. We gave a paper on this particular subject at the NAB in the spring show, and in that paper we showed some of the information from the stations in Puerto Rico that have been successfully running AM stereo or AM synchronous operation for over 20 years, still on an STA. But synchronous boosters can be used, for instance, to fill in the null area in a directional pattern, in a locally served area, simply by putting in a non-directional low-power antenna and filling in the null area. So what are the potential benefits to AM of synchronization? Well, first of all, the elimination of co-channel carrier beats that occur in the overlap region of co-channel stations. Because AM radio coverage is intrinsically interference limited, by reducing the co-channel beats, we can enlarge the useful coverage area. And I'll show that, talk about that further. And since the carrier is statistically stationary and 10 to 12 dB above the average modulation sideband power, a significant improvement in listenable coverage area is possible. And this can be an increase of 3 to 4 times. The bottom line is more coverage equals more listeners equals more revenue, which is, I know, what everybody's interested in. These show the co-channel limits that are currently in place for a Class A station, clear channel station, the 100 microvolt per meter contour daytime, and the 500 microvolt per meter, 50% skywave contour at night. And the interference contour is the five microvolt per meter contour, and the nighttime interference is 25 microvolt per meter. And for clear regional stations, it's 500 microvolts per meter daytime, 2,000 during the nighttime, with the interference being 25 microvolts per meter day and 25 at night. And then you see those for the local station here is 500 and 500, also for the Class D station. Other advantages of synchronization are, with static beats eliminated, Doppler shifts must be considered in stations' mild overlap areas for mobile receivers. And we're looking at cars, and we're looking at what effects can AM synchronization have on reception in cars. The technology makes the idea of synchronous phase tracking co-channel low-power AM repeaters feasible for filling in poor coverage areas. In addition, very wide area signal frequency network broadcasting with satellite audio distribution is also a possibility. AM stations could be used as reference frequencies. Receiver AGCs will no longer have to deal with beats. These are some of the advantages of synchronous operation. So this shows a situation where you have two stations with typical mobile receiver trajectories, and you have contours established by the two stations. And we can calculate what are the total beats here, and we can mainly, the maximum Doppler shift on path one of about 0.1 hertz per megahertz at the receiver velocity of 67 miles per hour is what is realizable in terms of the overlap area. This shows the implementation of what would be involved in a GPS time-based synchronous operation. We implemented these with two stations in East Tennessee using a Trimble GPS receiver, which we were able to couple into the external input of the exciter of each transmitter and synchronize the two transmitters very easily. And this is something that can be realized at a very low cost. And essentially you have a GPS timing receiver here, and you have a master phase lock loop, and that then drives a DDS here to a low power filter to the output with a carrier frequency and twice the carrier frequency here. And you can utilize either one of these as the output to the transmitter. As far as AM field listening observations, we have conducted tests of synchronous operation, as well as we've received feedback from the operators in Puerto Rico. And the carrier beats are the dominant effect, and the rates vary from subhertz to about 30 hertz. And this is, of course, due to the fact that your transmitter frequency is not exactly on frequency. It is deviating to some extent, and that's what creates these carrier beats. And it can sound, in some cases, like, you know, Donald Duck-type noise. The beats are much lower in expanded band because there are far fewer stations and newer transmitters. And the clutter is horrible on local channels with poor coverage resulting. Estimated overall typical improvement is 6 to 10 dB for most stations if you go to a synchronous operation. This shows what effectively can be the interference area with and without synchronization. And you can see here that this is the region here where you have carrier beats occurring, whereas if you go to a synchronous operation, it's reduced to this level here, strictly in the middle. So it's dramatically reduced. And this shows just a depiction of what would happen if you went to synchronous operation in terms of what would be the interference limited coverage of your station before and after. And this shows the new daytime coverage area here, and this shows the new nighttime. So you're going from this area here, essentially daytime, to this area effectively. So what are the pros and cons? The typical enlargement of your effective coverage area is 6 to 10 dB, which can be up to 4 to 9 times the equivalent listening audience. The elimination of all static beats, which are the most objectionable effect and the source of most tune-outs. Gains greatest for fast music speech programming. Reduction in co-channel beats also benefits HD reception. Reduced platform motion for CQAM AM stereo. Masking usually better on wider bandwidth receivers, so that's one of the reasons why we're particularly interested in it. It's a huge bang for the buck for broadcasters. It's a very low investment for a significant improvement in your coverage area. And it's a minor modification to your transmitter to accomplish it. The major benefit can occur if all stations participate, which is why we're encouraging the FCC to consider this possibility. So what can be done to fix AM radio? In summary, one is to adopt synchronous frequency control. Secondly, to install CQAM stereo exciters with GPS-based frequency sync, which allows all the transmitters to be synchronized with AM stereo. Report known sources of noise to the FCC website. Work with local congressmen and senators to encourage the establishment of new receiver standards. You know, I was, when we were involved in working on all this, and there was some press going out on it, I got a call from one of the original owners of Clear Channel Communications down in San Antonio, just an example about these receiver concerns, and he purchased a new Lexus every 6 years, every time they changed the model year. And he compared the receiver in the a 2013 Lexus and a 2006 Lexus. He has AM stations in that market. And he said the quality of the 2013 model receiver was so markedly worse than the 2006. he contacted the headquarters of Toyota in California, and they sent a team to visit him in San Antonio. And they proceeded to tell him that Pioneer made their radios and that they had left out two key software items that were supposed to go in those receivers, one of which was for noise suppression. And they weren't going to change that. And so that was an example of how, if we had had oversight in terms of these receivers coming into the country, that could have been avoided. So I think also, as far as the commission is concerned, I'll just tell you briefly, we had a team of people that you're familiar with. I know Jeff Mendenhall from Gates Air, Lynn Clawley and Bob Weller from NAB, Eric Wandell, the president of AFSCME currently, and a number of others put together a proposal to conduct a noise interference study that was presented on September 24th to the Technical Advisory Council. And this was through Lynn Clawley, who currently serves on the TAC. And the response to it was that they had too many issues. And the chairman of TAC, I'll just tell you, was one of the authors of that paper I showed you. But they said that they have too many issues before them and they can't address anything else right now. They said the number one issue on the agenda for the next TAC committee in 2017 will be noise. But that's 2017, folks. That's a long time off from now. And that's not good enough as far as I'm concerned. So we have to pursue further efforts to get something done. And it really needs all of your support. All right, so I think this is further what can be done to fix AM radio receivers, as I was saying. I think I'm not going to go over this, belabor this, because I've already touched on this, but we need better receivers, and we need less noise, and we need to be proactive in both areas. So the outlook for AM broadcasting, AM being the most spectrally efficient medium, has been essentially technologically orphaned by receiver makers. Beats and co-channel intermodulation, the source of most tune-outs. 10 kilohertz audio bandwidth afforded by NRSC specs along with CQAM stereo can provide very acceptable quality versus FM. The industry has done little to deter the generally miserable bandwidth of modern AM radios and has failed to effectively support AM stereo. AM receiver mandates are needed. The main needs are for better receiver performance and noise enforcement. And hopefully Joe Money is going to talk about that tomorrow night. That concludes my presentation. I'm certainly happy to address any questions.
2 points. Are you aware that one of the European vehicle manufacturers has discontinued AM in many of their car radios because they did not have a means by which to quell the AM noise being generated within the car?
Yes, sir. I'm very familiar with the BMW series that they have removed the AM receivers, and that was because of the high level of noise that was present in the car. And that's something that certainly could be dealt with if the industry insisted on it. But there was, I know, a major outcry among AM broadcasters that I know when that information came out.
Is there a call to action in the trade media for this industry, a sustained one planned?
Well, what I would recommend is that you make your concerns known to your local congressman and have them communicate to Greg Walden, the chairman of the House Senate and Commerce Subcommittee on Energy and Commerce, which oversees the FCC. And this is where the actual pressure needs to be applied. Because we've made this presentation to the FCC numerous times, and there's great interest in it, but when it comes to them doing anything, they really need to get their attention from higher up on Capitol Hill. And that's really where you, the broadcasters, need to be making your interest known and your concerns.
No further comment.
Okay.
You've raised some tremendous points, Tom. I would emphasize that a lot of the problems with noise affect the FM broadcast band in roughly similar levels of impact, but the effect is more hidden by the nature of FM receivers. So a lot of times we're running at Wisconsin Public Radio, we're running into listeners who previously could hear the station but can't hear it anymore. And when you work with them a little bit, you discover there's some new consumer electronics in their house that has caused the loss of reception. Another instance was the traffic light interference that you mentioned. In this case, it was bothering FM reception. And I actually was able to get a field engineer from the FCC to come out and check the situation. He confirmed my findings. He said they're far in violation of Part 15. But he said, I'll be going back to Chicago. There's nothing I can do. And I said, well, isn't there a next step? They're in violation. He said, well, no, you should just tell your listeners to find a stronger station.
You know, this is a reflection on the mentality of the FCC today, is that they're not supporting broadcast, they're supporting broadband. And the fact is that noise is affecting broadband too. And I know Jeff Welton's going to be talking about FM interference in LTE space, which we're hearing a lot more about that ourselves because we're making equipment to deal with that. But it is ever since the telecom carriers have dropped the noise floor, they have opened the gate for a lot of higher order artifacts from FM and other sources to impact their service. And so they're raising their hands and, you know, concerned about it. And the fact is that data needs to be taken and measurements need to be made, because that's what, if you go back and talk to Julius Knapp at the Office of Engineering and Technology, he's going to tell you, I want to see data. I want to see the problem from not just a anecdotal nature, but I want to actually see some numbers to tell me this is a real problem. And so that's one of the things that we were trying to work through TAC to get this going, and there's going to be other avenues we're going to pursue now.
I'm from Green Bay, and the Wisconsin Public Service years ago used to do a very good job on noisy insulators. They had an engineer that would come out, and he had an antenna, and he'd pin it right down. They'd change him out. He's retired, and it's just got god-awful. No matter where you drive, noisy insulators in the power pole. And the other thing that I found that causes a lot of AM interference are these cheap converting power supplies, whether they're on an iPad or a cell phone or a telephone like a Panasonic telephone system. They're just terrible, and something should be done about that.
Yes, well, I would agree. I've talked to some directors of engineering, Glenn Walden being one, who spoke about, he went out actually to visit some of the homes of listeners that complained that they couldn't receive the station on their radio in their home. And one lady had a LED lamp right over her radio. As soon as they turned that off, it was fine. His program director at KYW couldn't hear his station in his home because he had an LCD television on to babysit their children all day. And as soon as they turned that off, everything was fine. Comcast modem was creating noise, and they turned that off. Everything. So, it's a large problem. This matter of noise, and the question I know that the FCC asks is, well, how do we deal with this huge problem? And I think one of the things we have to do is we have to collect data of all these different sources as we know them, and categorize them in terms of their level of contribution of noise. and deal with the most troublesome guys first. And that's what I think is the approach that we're recommending. It's a problem that can be dealt with. It just has to be systematically looked at. And there has to be support from you, the industry, to say that we really need to do this. Any other questions?
Hi, Tom. I have a question, too, like this gentleman who said about insulators. I built a directional antenna to accommodate an FIM and went and found that about 60% of the utility insulators are bad. But what is happening, anybody that's governed by the PSC, like XL Energy, you tell them about it, they'll fix it. It's the cooperatives that say, we don't have to fix it, we don't want to do anything about it, and we're not going to fix it. What do you suggest on doing with that?
I would suggest that you go to your state public utility commission and address that with them and tell them you're not getting cooperation with the local co-op, and ask them to intervene in that situation. Any other questions? Commissioner Clyburn, when we were talking about this, she was very quick to encourage connecting with the public utility commissions in each state and being assured that they are well informed about any issues that are occurring. So, and she's a former broadcaster herself, a minority broadcaster. She's pro-radio, there's no question. She and Ajit Pai are the two that are, and I think Commissioner O'Reilly, the three of them are more pro-broadcast than any of the rest of them. But I think that it really takes a lot more involvement by you, the broadcaster, to make it known to the FCC. Go back, go to this website, contact them with your issues, flood them with problems, and help them to see that, you know, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just a question on the synchronous operations that there obviously aren't that many of them that are working. We get the theoretical aspect of it, but what does the listener experience sound like when you're sort of traveling in through nulls? Say, for example, you have a cloverleaf pattern. How do you fill in something like that? Actually, there are several questions embedded in here, I guess, but what is the listener experience like? And then what type of a typical investment would be required for a broadcaster? Obviously, would be sort of a non-directional, probably fairly simple piece of equipment, I'm guessing, that would fill in nulls for AM broadcasters. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, sir. The best example, I think, of successful synchronous operators are a group down in Puerto Rico, which I can give you their information, but there is a requirement to delay the program relative to the carrier in order to see seamless transition through the overlap region. And these guys have really, over the years of doing this, they've learned how to do it well. And they are, they say that listeners, they have no problem with any interference or dropout in the overlap region. So I think I can give you their information. I think as far as the cost for implementation, it all depends on, you know, to what extent, because I know they have a second directional station that they use for their synchronous operation. And it can be just a single short tower, or it could be a matter of diplexing onto an existing station. It could be a matter of putting up, a low profile antenna of some type. You do have to have a ground system, you know, is the thing that. So you've got to have some land, but it really depends on the case. And if you're talking a 1 kilowatt. And putting up a tower with a ground system and everything, you're talking probably, with installation and everything, probably $30,000-$40,000, just as an example. I think I'm all done on time, so thank you very much and appreciate all the questions.
Thank you, Tom.